In the 1840s, travellers said they could smell Preston from 40 miles away. Such was the stench of an industrial town with no sewerage system. But the middle classes were affected as well. Diseases incubated amidst all that stench impacted on them. The Great Victorian Building Programme of sewage systems and fresh water resulted. Inequality, the Victorians realised, impacted on everyone. But they were reluctant converts. Victorians thought the poor should do more to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps, while the rich, writing society's script, thought they deserved their wealth. Sound familiar? As the cost of living crisis comes to a head, and thousands more people find themselves living on the breadline each day, the role of the social sciences in unpicking these arguments and showing just how inequality affects us all has never been more important. Professor Kate Pickett is a social epidemiologist who has devoted her working career to narrowing this inequality gap.
Sense of purpose and agency and that social connectivity, that's the sort of triad at the heart of well-being, I think. It adds a sort of weight of psychosocial burden to each and every one of us. And it's about what happens to society and what happens to each of us individually when that social ladder is steeper and when the rungs are further apart.
That's Professor Kate Pickett on how inequality impacts us all on The We Society with me, Will Hutton, brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences. Hello, today I'm speaking to Professor Kate Pickett, a leading social epidemiologist at the University of York. Her findings on inequality from her 2009 book, The Spirit Level, which she co-authored with Richard Wilkinson, was unique. It was picked up by both sides of the political divide and changed the political weather. Inequality didn't just matter to those at the wrong end of the scale, but to all of us. David Cameron and Ed Miliband, then leader of the opposition, both quoted her work. The book was a bestseller, selling more than 150,000 copies worldwide. But since then, Kate hasn't been idle. She's published countless research papers, comment pieces, and is currently spearheading the Born in Bradford study, where her team have been tracking the lives of thousands of babies and their families since 2007 to find out why some children stay healthy while others fall ill. She also chaired the Independent Inequality Commission for the Manchester City. Kate, welcome, and thanks for joining us on The We Society.
Happy to join you, Will. It's a pleasure to be here.
When we called you and asked you to do this and said it's sort of a podcast series called The We Society, what thought process, what reaction did that trigger in you? The very name.
Oh, I was really, really pleased, actually. Two reasons. One is I think it's high time that we started to shift the conversation and to really focus on having a more collective, collaborative society where we recognise the value of everybody's contribution, where we're not all, you know, elbows out for ourselves. It's not so about competition. It's more about collaboration. But also because I'm involved with quite a lot of people who are thinking about well-being economies. And so that's abbreviated to WE. So I was happy for both of those reasons that we'd be having this conversation.
And what do you see as the major threats? I mean, the WE Society is a nice idea. I mean, I've helped coin it. But it's not yet a common currency. And it's not, and there's lots of adversaries out there, people who stress individualism and individual agency and individual responsibility. And if there's a WE Society, it's very much kind of an afterthought rather than right up there.
So, it's got a lot of weight to push against, hasn't it? It's got to push against all of those years of neoliberalism, you know, all of those decades during which we've been told by people in power, by economic thinkers, that the neoliberal way, the individualistic way, the free market way is the only way, and that anything else, anything more progressive is woolly-minded liberal thinking. But actually, that's all we've got to push against, because I think all the evidence is in favour of a WE economy. You know, all the evidence suggests that we will get greater well-being, greater productivity, you know, that there is not a price to pay. And so I think the major challenge is just one of shifting aside that weight of this is how we've done things. We need to change the conversation. But I don't think there are any serious barriers to doing that other than people just being stuck in an old-fashioned mindset.
When I look at the spirit level, it was, really quite something. I mean, I think I don't know how surprised you were at the reaction to it, but a lot of people were surprised at how it kind of took off in the way it took off. But just spell out. I mean, here you are. You know, I'd love you just to spell out. It's an overused phrase, but the elevator pitch. You know, you've got 60 seconds in the elevator with the leader of the opposition or the prime minister. What are you going to say?
Not a problem. So in the spirit level, what Richard Wilkinson and I showed was that inequality affects a very wide range of health and social issues. Everything from physical health, mental health, obesity, infant mortality rates, through to things like levels of societal trust, violence, how kids do in school, social mobility, you know, very wide range of issues. The second thing is that the effect of inequality on those outcomes is large. You know, we're not just talking about small differences between more and less equal societies. We're talking about big differences. Eightfold difference in teenage pregnancy rates, 16-fold differences in rates of imprisonment, for instance. But also, and you referred to this, I think, at the very beginning of our chat, that inequality affects everybody. It isn't just the poor. The effects are largest on those at the bottom of society, but the impact runs all the way up the social ladder. So that even you and I, Will, you know, with high levels of income, education, you know, high levels of social class, we would do better in a more equal society, and so would our children. So those were the three profound messages, really, from the spirit level.
Nobody is going to argue that actually being disadvantaged, being poor, and not having kind of the wherewithal to kind of house yourself, eat properly, clothe yourself properly, all of those are going to have profound knock-on consequences on your life chances. So, you know, I mean, all the great faiths and all the great morality systems have that as a cardinal point. So no one's going to dispute that. I think where people are going to kind of, and do kind of raise sometimes a red flag and sometimes kind of challenge you is, but you're going beyond that. I mean, you're saying, yes, but what matters to the way people see themselves is actually how they are, how they stand relative to others in a society. I mean, have I got that right?
Yes, you've got that absolutely right. So it's about socioeconomic position, relative social position, and it's about what happens to society and what happens to each of us individually when that social ladder is steeper and when the rungs are further apart. It makes it harder for all of us to avoid the problems of status comparison. It adds a sort of weight of psychosocial burden to each and every one of us all the way up that social ladder. And that has really strong effects on our well-being, on our health and how we think and how we feel and how we behave. And you know, you sort of said red flag and what worries people, but this isn't just what we think. This is what the data show. So it is strong, robust social science.
Spell out some of that data, Kate. Spell that out. I mean, convince a half-persuaded listener that actually they've got to take this stuff really seriously.
Sure. So the data come from all kinds of sources. We've got lots of comparative studies that compare different countries, different rich, developed countries, and look at levels of social problems in those. We've got studies that compare the 50 American states. So you can't say that those differences are due to, you know, cultural differences between countries.
So let's say some of the states in New England are kind of less unequal than some of the states in the Deep South. So from that, what behaviors are resulting? I mean, is life expectancy, is mental stress less in those New England states than, say, the Deep South?
Well, life expectancy is higher and mental health problems are lower. Levels of trust are higher in those more equal states. Children do better in school. You know, it's all of the same problems that we see affected by inequality in different countries. We see those same patterns in the United States. So since we published the spirit level, obviously things don't stand still, and the data just keep accumulating. You know, Richard and I get sent studies to review all the time that confirm what we were showing two decades ago. So it's an increasingly robust and an increasingly sure body of social science that needs to be acted on.
I'm struck at an observation made earlier on. Just like to kind of mine a bit what you're thinking on this, which is, you know, what goes on in people's heads, you know, the mental illness, the psychological consequences of this, both for those at the wrong end of the scale and those at the top. I mean, what I'd be very interested in you to paint a kind of a map of what's going on here.
Well, it's because we are social animals. You know, we are at a very biological heart. We are connected to one another in important ways, and that's how we survive. And so we're sort of evolutionarily programmed to see our social relationships as extremely important. You know, we depend on cooperation with others for survival, and therefore social relationships matter a lot. And those social relationships, you know, our connectivity to other people, lies at the heart of whether we feel secure or whether we feel insecure, whether we're worried about how other people see us or not. And in a more unequal society, all of those stresses get sort of ratcheted up. So we're all more concerned about status. We're all more concerned about our friendships and how others view us. And that links into our stress biology. And that's why we get these causal pathways from greater inequality through to all the kinds of health and social problems we've been discussing. The key mechanism at its heart is stress biology, the biology of chronic stress, and the ways in which our social relationships impact on that stress biology.
I mean, I've seen studies, and I'm sure you know them. I mean, you know, people at the top of the civil service, for example, have high-stress jobs, but actually their life expectancy is actually longer than those who have less stress jobs further down the kind of hierarchy of the civil service. And you know, what's buoying them up is their sense that they are somebody, that actually what they're doing is important. And you
exactly, it's high stress, but it's high reward.
But not high reward necessarily financially. I mean, top civil servants, I mean, they're being paid some fraction of what people at the top of business get paid, but they still, you know, feel, you know, intensely rewarded and consequently satisfied with their lives.
So they are at the top of a hierarchy, and they also have a huge amount of agency and control over their work, over their lives. And so that buoys up their sense of psychosocial security, if you will. It reduces their levels of chronic stress. Whereas those at the bottom, who we might have in the past thought of as not having stressful jobs, actually they are experiencing more psychosocial stress because of where they sit in those hierarchies and how they feel relative to other people.
Is that the heart of it, agency?
It's a key part of it. Agency, but also connectivity, you know, the quality of your social relationships, whether or not you've got friends, social support, people you can count on, whether you feel people like you, appreciate you, respect you. So agency and then how those relationships make you feel, yeah, they're very much at the heart of it.
So this is kind of the we society, kind of in action, or rather not in action.
Not in action, exactly. Yeah.
And I mean, I'm very struck that you got into all of this. I mean, nutrition, epidemiology was health was your kind of intellectual academic interest when you were kind of setting out an academic career, but you've got pulled into, or it feels to me, I mean, you put me right, you've got pulled into reflecting on inequality as a consequence. But it wasn't really that your prime preoccupation, was public health.
Yes, at the very start of my career. So I went, after studying anthropology, I went to America to study nutritional sciences. And at the time, I was thinking that the kinds of problems I was concerned about were problems in the developing world, problems in the global south. You know, I was worried about malnutrition. I was worried about children's health. And I thought that's where I'd spend my career, where I'd spend my life. And it didn't take me long to realize that all the problems I had previously thought of as what we used to call third world problems were right there on my doorstep in America. Malnutrition, deprivation, poverty, stunting, all of the things I'd been worried about were right there. And they were there in deprived areas. They were there among ethnic minorities. They were there among the poor. So I quite quickly got drawn into social epidemiology and the social sciences to try and think about why it was that in our rich, developed market democracies, there was so much suffering on display. So I still think of myself as a scientist, but I think of myself as a social scientist as well. You know, my tools are scientific, but I suppose my thinking is heavily social scientific.
And as a social scientist, you're hoping all of us kind of unlock what's going on. Before we carry on the conversation, just a quick word about the organisation behind the podcast series. The Academy of Social Sciences is a national body established in 1982. It's for academics, practitioners and learned societies in the social sciences. As the leading independent voice in the UK, it champions the vital role social sciences play in education, in government and in business. What is that role? Well, social sciences help us to understand the human world. That means solving grand challenges like climate change, wealth creation, or energy crises. It might mean working out the practicalities of levelling up the regions of Britain, monitoring happiness, maintaining standards of education, or addressing racial equality. Or it could be providing vital context for issues affecting public health, or working out a better way for our cities to be designed and planned. You can find out more about the Academy of Social Sciences work by going to the website acss.org.uk. That's acss.org.uk. Or you can follow us on Twitter at @acadsocsciences. You'll find those details in our show notes. So, back to the conversation. The first two chapters of the government's white paper on levelling up, written by Andy Haldane, former chief economist of the Bank of England, and actually given a big tick by Michael Gove, the Secretary of State for Levelling Up and Communities. They say that if you were to really get this right and succeed in levelling up, in bringing kind of productivity and all the things that buttress it up to the levels of London and the South East, the UK economy in 25 years' time would be £2 trillion pounds larger than it would otherwise be. I mean, there's amazing sums of money. And of course, one of the things they, you know, they identify 12 areas for action. And one of which is, of course, you know, investment in early years. So there's, you know, I mean, whatever you may think of Boris Johnson, I park all the Partygate and all the rest of it to one side. I mean, he is a Conservative Prime Minister who has talked this language, and yet translating it again into effective action,
Yeah, that doesn't happen.
I mean, it doesn't happen. But
and if we think about health inequalities, you know, the UK had the first government-commissioned report on health inequalities in the world back in 1980, the Black Report, and it pointed out, you know, the problem of health inequalities, and it said what needed to be done, including things like investing in early childhood, and nothing happened because it came out, it was commissioned by Labour government, but it came out at the start of Margaret Thatcher's Conservative government. So nothing was done to tackle that. We had another government report in the 90s. We had Sir Michael Marmot's review of health inequalities in 2010. We had his 10-year-on review in 2020. And they all show the same health inequalities gap. They all point to the same solutions to tackle it. they all point out how much we would gain economically and otherwise if we did tackle them. And yet successive government after government doesn't tackle them in any profound way. So it's not just a problem of this government, it's a problem of previous governments as well. You know, why don't they act on the evidence that would suggest that they would really benefit if they did? And now we have a levelling up agenda, which, yes, it sounds good. And I agree with you that the levelling up report is strongly worded and suggests a real intention to do something. But we need to see it backed up very, very quickly by action. Otherwise, it is just another talking shop, you know, another suggestion that things will be done. And will they be done in the lifetime of this parliament?
There seems to be a need in our political class to kind of tear an institution down and rebrand it as somehow, if that was a left-of-centre institution, then we're going to rebrand it and get to the same kind of destination, but with right-of-centre kind of terminology. And then you flip it round and the left want to do the same. And we don't have in the UK a kind of stable institutional structure, except the National Health Service and perhaps the BBC, although that's now being attacked. And actually, what you need is a kind of critical mass of politicians in both parties or both main parties who kind of accept that a functioning institution that works should be kept in place and made to work better rather than dismantled. I don't know. One of the points of this podcast series, in a way, is to kind of help create a kind of a recognition that the best social science kind of could underpin a stabler view to support institutions that function and function well.
I think that's right. I mean, that's what the social sciences are for, aren't they? Richard often uses the terminology of a social microscope. You know, our social sciences methods are like applying a social microscope to the big problems in society, whether it's inequality, poverty, education, you know, any of the big issues, health inequalities. Our social science methods show us how to zero in on those things and understand what the most important factors are that influence them. And that's our purpose in life, I think, as social scientists. It isn't just to describe problems. It is to understand their causes and then to think about solutions. But I think that's quite difficult. I mean, I think when I started out, I thought all you had to do was show the problem. You know, when we published The Spirit Level, we thought, well, if we demonstrate to the world that inequality is a problem, then people will do something about it. But it's not quite that simple. And I think, you know, it surprised us at the start that we would sit on platforms with politicians and they would turn to us and say, well, what do we do about it? And so I think what we lack are institutions where those two things can come together, where those with real expertise and real understanding can engage with those with power and decision-making capability in ways that are grown up and non-adversarial and collegial and problem-solving. So I'm not quite sure how we do that, but I think it feels like there's a real need for that kind of approach as we go forward.
Was your desperation to kind of get that to happen that led to you endorsing Jeremy Corbyn's leadership back in 2015 as leadership candidature?
I think what we saw with Jeremy Corbyn's policies were a manifesto of things that were really progressive and that we could really see would make a transformative difference. I mean, what really interested me about Corbyn's policies is that when they were taken anonymously to Conservative voters, they endorsed them as well. You know, there was a lot of collective appreciation for some of the things that were being suggested. And yet, of course, they got labelled as far left. They get labelled as, you know, crazy left. And so, you know, we didn't see that manifesto able to get taken forward. There wasn't the agency or the political will or the capability to make it happen. But the policies themselves were really popular, and they were popular across the political divide. Not all of them, of course, but a substantial number were.
If you were to identify, say three things that you would want to do quickly, what would they be?
Well, there's the realistic ones and then there's the more fantastical ones, I suppose. I mean, realistically, right now, if I had policy-making capabilities, I would increase child benefit and I would make it universal once again. I would reinstate the £20 universal credit uplift that we saw provided during the COVID pandemic. So those would be the two things I would do first. I suppose the second would be investment in Sure Start centres, early childhood interventions, anything we can do in that arena to get children off to the best start in life. But I would also want to tackle some of the engines of inequality, generation and entrenchment, including private education. I think we should remove charitable status from private schools, from private education. I think we should have what the Finns had in the 1970s, you know, a big national conversation about education, making it public in its entirety, making it comprehensive, making it good for everybody. And then if you still left me some wand-waving powers, I suppose I would be doing things about taxation, wealth tax, land tax possibly, and universal basic income.
I just want to focus for a second on young kids. I mean, I don't think people quite recognise how phenomenal work has been done, just showing how, you know, the son or a daughter of a middle-class child by the age of three will have heard, you know, many, many more words with different meanings than the son or daughter of a disadvantaged parent. And actually, that opens up synapses in your brain and actually has cognitive kind of results that last throughout your life. And actually, these Sure Start centres aren't just about making sure that, you know, kids get the right food and nutrition and all the rest of it. It's about actually ensuring that they get talked to, they get played with, they get exemplars of, you know, how to behave, all those things which connect up in a rapidly growing young brain the synapses that will improve their cognitive and mental capacities as they age.
It's not that poor parents don't love or want to nurture their children or provide stimulating environments. You know, often our kids who are living in poverty are in families where somebody's working and they're working long hours. You know, parents are stressed, they're trying to make ends meet, and that's going to get tougher and tougher with this cost of living crisis. They're tired, they're suffering from stress themselves. And so the kind of parenting that we would wish to see provided for all children, it gets constrained by all of those external pressures on families themselves. So it's not that parents in poor areas don't want the best for their children or aren't striving to provide it. It's just that the circumstances of their lives make that so much more difficult. And Sure Start centres can alleviate some of that. They provide, as you say, spaces that foster cognitive development, but they also act as places where that kind of thing is modelled. So they're beneficial in multiple ways.
And we know that actually the circumstances of more people in the kind of Midlands and the north of England are kind of the problems you talk about are more acute there. Again, I mean, I'm. Is there any progress whatsoever? I mean, you did this independent commission in Manchester, and that was warmly welcomed by the mayor, Andy Burnham. Has that much resulted from your efforts? But I tell you why I ask. I'm very struck that actually culture change and recognition of these things tends to precede regulation and law. You know, if we can win the battle of ideas, if the underlying culture starts to change, we may get to Denmark. We may arrive at the destination that we both want.
So what I see in the north among people I encounter is a willingness to innovate and think creatively about tackling some of these problems at the kind of level where things can be done, but not everything can be done. So the Independent Inequalities Commission that I chaired was for Greater Manchester City region, not just the city of Manchester. And there, I did encounter a real thirst for evidence, a real wish to do things differently. And yet, of course, a combined authority or a local authority, there are limits on what they can do. So there are certain things they can tackle and other things that only national government can do. So when I'm working at local, regional level, I'm finding a lot of energy and a lot of willingness to do things differently. But obviously that's at a scale that is local and regional, and we do still need certain kinds of action at national level. So, you know, a local authority has limited ways in which to tackle inequality within its area. It can increase council tax for everybody, but it cannot change the ratio of income tax bands. So it can't actually differentially choose to raise more from the rich within its area or region than from the poor. And so local authorities, combined authorities, have certain powers, certain devolved powers, certain funding, certain capabilities. But some of what they could do if they were given more powers, that they can't do because it's not within their remit. So I see the energy there, though, and I see a real focus on tackling local problems. You know, in Bradford, we talk about creating a city of research where citizens are engaged in research and where research is benefiting the whole city area. You know, in Greater Manchester, I did find a real willingness to think innovatively about what kinds of public policy would really change things for all of the people experiencing inequality.
Let's just go to the Born in Bradford study. I mean, are there any standout findings so far? I mean, the idea is to track, rather as they've done in the States in the Framlington study, you know, to do over a period of decades almost, you know, track the lives of kids as they grow up and establish what the dynamics are of health and lack of health.
So we have lots of really good what are called birth cohort studies in this country, in the UK. You know, we have one from babies born in 1946 all the way through to babies born around the millennium. But Born in Bradford is a local, a place-based birth cohort study where we're following the lives of children born in Bradford in the late 2000s. And so they're right about now, you know, they're going to secondary school and just about to sort of embark on their adolescent journey. And we've just received funding from the Wellcome Trust, actually, to follow them for the next 7 years. So we're going to be taking all the children through into adulthood and being able to look at the course of their adolescence and the things that are influencing their educational attainment, their health well-being, their social well-being as well. And we're actually expanding the study to include all children in the Bradford classrooms where we're going. So we're actually going to have 30,000 young people in the study over the next 7 years. So from its inception, it's been producing important findings about ethnic differences in health and well-being. It's been providing us with information about the impact of poverty and deprivation in Bradford, but it's enabled us to change things locally. So we've been able to tackle pollution locally because we had study findings showing that pollution was affecting infant child development. We're able to change things so that actually we were screening all pregnant women for gestational diabetes. Diabetes is much bigger risk in our population in Bradford than it is elsewhere. So because we're local, we can turn research findings into policy, whether it's clinical policy or public policy, quite rapidly. So these sorts of studies, they produce new findings throughout their lifetime, and you can use the findings to change and influence well-being as you go.
And are you picking up any? I mean, it's a slightly kind of lateral thought I had while you were talking, but I mean, there's a lot of concern amongst middle-class parents about the amount of time their kids are spending, you know, looking at mobile phones, looking at playing video games, that actually it's kind of beginning, it impairs cognitive ability.
We are going to be studying that as the kids go through their teenage years. studies have really only been able to do this recently. It's a very recent phenomenon, but we are going to be asking young people about not just how much time they spend on social media or looking at screens, but what are they doing? Because, of course, social media can be positive and beneficial for children and young people as well as just negative. So we will be trying to get at the subtleties and the complexities of that.
Because there's a lot of evidence that, I mean, teenagers, you know, I mean, I saw one number that 26% of 14 to 16-year-olds think that what they're going to do with their life is kind of win Strictly Come Dancing or, you know, play for a top Premier League football team. I mean, there's a way in which kind of social media is kind of distorting people's kind of vision of possibility.
I think that's right. It's not just social media, though. I think inequality does that as well. I mean, back when Richard Wilkinson and I published The Spirit Level, we had found that social mobility was much higher in more equal societies, but children's aspirations, as measured in one international study, sort of went the other way. So you ended up with this really sad situation of, in the more unequal societies where children had least opportunity for social mobility, their aspirations were, you know, disproportionately high. Again, it's this sort of, I want to be a basketball star or a music star, I want to be famous, because money and status matter more in those societies. They matter more, but fewer people have access to them. So I think you're right, you know, inequality and through the mechanism social media does distort people's realistic expectations about what their lives might be like and what opportunities are available to them.
It's kind of fantastical. You're invited to escape the here and now by living in a fantastical fantasy world.
Yeah, and I think what really worries me is that, you know, as young people leave school, as they enter the adult world, it's a bit of a cliff edge. You know, we spend a lot of time nurturing our children and the young people to believe that, you know, anything's possible. But actually, the world is quite difficult and increasingly difficult, I think, for children and young people. And we need to find ways to make them resilient to that, but also to prepare them for the various kinds of contributions they will be making in society. We can't all be famous and we can't all be super rich, but we can all have purposeful work and we can all have well-being.
I'm struck by this, I mean, purpose, you know, giving purpose to your life and working for organizations that themselves have purpose is a key building block, I think, in mental well-being. I don't know whether you...
No, I agree. Again, the research is really solid on this, that a sense of purpose is really important for our mental health and well-being. And of course, that's not to do with the amount of material resources we have, but it is, again, about whether we feel that we're making a difference in life and that we are respected and appreciated and supported and that we have the social connections that support our well-being. So sense of purpose and agency and that social connectivity, that's the sort of triad at the heart of well-being, I think. And then big structural things like inequality change that for all of us. So they're connected to those deeply intimate things. But inequality, poverty, deprivation, you know, the availability of good work, employment and good wages, all of those things which feel like great big social problems end up having these individual impacts through our very sort of more intimate relationships, our social relationships and how we feel about ourselves.
I think that's at the heart of your thinking. Professor Pickett, thank you so much for giving up your time. Really a very interesting conversation. And I'm trying to quickly summarize what we've discussed. I mean, I think at the heart of it are two or three propositions. First of all, it's not absolute poverty that matters. It's actually how we as social animals relate to one another. And when you get levels of inequality that are very severe, there's a cascade of issues that flow, everything from life expectancy to mental well-being, and even effort at work that actually flow from that. I thought your proposition of the triad, that actually the good life is about having a sense of purpose, having a sense of agency, and being connected to the society of which you are part, was a very useful way of framing what you said. Thank you too for all the multiple references to social science and the data and evidence that supports this. I mean, whether it's comparisons in America, whether it's what's happening in Bradford, I mean, it was really, you grounded it fantastically. So thank you. And of course, you are an advocate of kind of levelling up, which we hope would be one way of building cross-party support for all this. So thank you for listening to The We Society. From the Academy of Social Sciences, I'm Will Hutton. And to be among the first to find out about future episodes, please subscribe in the usual ways. That's to our website. And why not leave us a review as well? And to find out more about us at the Academy, head to acss.org.uk or follow us on Twitter. Until the next time, thank you. Thank you for listening and goodbye. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences, acss.org.uk. I'm Will Hutton. The producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production.